Development. First case for argument is Allen Block v. County Materials. Mr. Ahrens.
On 13A, Judge Shabazz erred in his decision denying the defendant's motion for summary judgment to dismiss the complaint as a compulsory counterclaim in the first case because Judge Shabazz made a mistake of law about the identicality between the two contracts, the 97 and the 93 contract. Judge Shabazz recognized that the 93 contract was obviously in front of the court in the first case, but then in his decision, and it's clear that he speaks of the language of the two covenants not identical, and he suggests that they raise different legal issues because the defendant had disputed that it was bound by the 97 agreement. Now, this is exactly the kind of test that was rejected by this court back in 30 years ago in the Warshawski case, where the court said, in our view, such arguments represent an effort to have this court apply the identity of issues, res judicata, or same evidence tests rather than the crucial logical relationship test. And it may have been that Judge Shabazz's obvious awareness of the Gutreiter case, a district court case that said a claim for breach of a covenant not to compete is a compulsory counterclaim for a declaratory judgment on that covenant, may have focused him too much on a single contract. In the Warshawski case, there were two different contracts. One was written, one was oral.
You ought to say something about, or provide some context for your argument. I don't understand you. What are you talking about? What's the issue?
Well, the issue is that the complaint should have been dismissed because it was presented compulsory counterclaims that were required to have been brought in the first suit between County Materials and Allen Block, which was commenced in November of 2005. In that case, County Materials sought a declaratory judgment that the covenant not to compete.
So this is your argument about res judicata?
No, we did not at any time raise res judicata. We only raised
a compulsory counterclaim to a declaratory judgment action. Is that what you're arguing?
Exactly.
And what else? So is this really a cross appeal you're filing? I'm just confused.
We are here in the second appeal in the second case.
I mean, you're listed as a cross. Oh, I see. No. You're not the cross appellant. Right. Okay. Now, this the case that was decided just last month between these parties, has that wiped out the last issue, the issue about the patent misuse? What's the bearing of that decision on our case?
Well, it can go two ways. The first way is if Allen Block's...
How do you think it goes?
Well, I think the case was decided incorrectly because we never...
What is the bearing of this September 18th decision on the present appeals?
Okay. I believe that the trial court judge believed that his early...
Look, I'm not asking you that. I'm asking, what is the bearing of this September 18th decision on these appeals?
If it's res judicata...
Not if, please. Just tell me, what is your view of how this decision, if at all, affects how we should decide these appeals?
I believe it confirms that 13A applies here. That's what I believe. And if it does not do that, then we can revisit the entire issue of the illegality of the separate 97 agreement. But Allen argued to the trial...
Did Judge Wood talk about compulsory counterclaims?
No, because I think at the last argument, the judge was...
What does this decision have to do with our decision?
I think it renders 13... It means that... It disposes of the issue.
Of which issue?
The preemption issue. And because it disposes of the preemption issue, it means for both contracts.
So you're point five in your brief. That's now moot. Is that what you're saying?
I believe it's moot.
Okay.
It disposes of the preemption issue because it means that the claim regarding the 97 agreement was also a compulsory counterclaim in the first case. Judge Shabazz looked for different...
But your problem is that we don't require compulsory counterclaims to declaratory judgment actions.
There is no exception for that.
Oh, no, there has to be.
But there isn't.
I mean, compulsory counterclaim and res judicata, that's the same thing. Right? The same thing. You're not allowed to split your claim. That's a basic principle of res judicata. And if you have a compulsory counterclaim, you're not permitted to separate that from your complaint. Right? So it's the same thing.
Well, I would just simply...
For declaratory judgments, you don't have a... You aren't required to do that for, you know, practical reasons. You don't want to bog down the declaratory judgment with a bunch of other claims.
Well, that would directly conflict with this court's decision in Warshawski versus Arcata, where the court says rejected arguments about the identity of issues, res judicata, were the same evidence. So the court in Warshawski very clearly says res judicata and compulsory counterclaims are not the same.
Is that a declaratory judgment case?
No, but there is no case that says a declaratory judgment...
Why do you think compulsory counterclaims are required to be filed, you know? Why do you think there is a rule about compulsory counterclaims? You think that rule is unrelated to res judicata?
I think the rule is... Warshawski says it's unrelated to res judicata. They have similar fact. They run along similar lines, but Rule 13A is a rule. It is not a judge-made doctrine. Res judicata, it has a different name now, is a judge-made doctrine. Warshawski says the analysis is different. The rule says any claim you have. There is no exception in 13A for a declaratory judgment.
Well, in this case, I'm trying to understand this.
Right.
It seems to me that declaratory judgment action is a pretty minor point here on this non-compete clause. And if it's necessary to file counterclaims raising every issue that's been raised here, which ended up having to be tried in front of a jury and all that, it would have bogged down that, as Judge Posner says, that first case.
Well, it certainly wouldn't have bogged down...
It's a pretty simple issue. Is that non-compete clause valid or not?
It wouldn't have bogged down the first case because Judge Shabazz would have tried this case as fast as he tried it the second time, in a few months. He tried it in 3 days. It would have been a simple matter of having all these claims decided. If I may, I'd like to go to the issue of the notice and cure. The contract, in fact, both of these agreements, 93 and 97, contained a provision that required either party to give the other party a notice of default and an opportunity to cure. It stipulated Allen never did that. The trial court said...
They acted under that other provision, which just allows for 120 days notice, didn't they?
Well, but the notice and cure is broader than simply giving them an opportunity to terminate. It says when you declare a default by the notice of cure, then you may terminate and or seek relief at law.
But I thought that this contract had two distinct ways of ending the relationship, and one was no cause is necessary after this has been in effect for a year, and it was in effect here for about 8 years, that either side can walk away with 120 days notice.
We didn't argue that they terminated inappropriately. We didn't fight the termination. What we said is because our obligations continue after the termination, their obligation to give us notice continues. And that doesn't excuse...
What do you mean your obligations continue after the termination?
Well, they argued that we had a non-compete that continued 18 months after the effective date of the termination. So if our obligations continued, then their obligation to give us notice of a breach continued. But they didn't give us notice of the breaches that occurred that they later alleged to have occurred before the termination. And in that case, what we have here is a circumstance where they lay it simply, you know, the notice on cure provision is in a contract to prevent one side from quietly accumulating grievances to be sprung later on. That's why it's there. That's why it's bargained for. Allen never gave us a notice. But and it's remarkable. In the first case, they tried to dismiss the first case saying there was no case or controversy because we weren't breaching the non-compete, because we hadn't made a victory block yet. Then in the second case, they sued us for breaching the non-compete.
So your argument, so your argument is that when they terminate the contract, the 18-month covenant not to compete clicks in, and you say that if they accuse you of breaking that contract, they have to give you this notice. Is that your argument?
That's my argument. That's what the contract says. And they had to give us notice about the claims of that we breached before they terminated the contract, and they didn't do that either. Now, I'd like to turn now to the damages case. This is a remarkable circumstance where there is no trial testimony of any kind from the witness stand by the plaintiff stating a dollar figure of damage. No one testified. In fact, the uncontradicted testimony from the stand was that there was no number that the plaintiff had for any damage. That was the testimony that was given at the 30B6 deposition. That was the testimony that came in at trial. The defendants suggested that they would have an expert testify about damages, but Judge Shabazz excluded the expert on the grounds that the expert had no opinions and, in fact, simply described him as a human calculator. Judge Shabazz sustained the damages award on the grounds that two licensees had talked about the fact that they didn't meet expected projections. But there's no evidence in the record of any kind as to the number of units that they felt that they were falling short on. And their testimony was about a period in 2006, even though the only numbers offered were for a period 2003 through 2005. So what we have is the circumstance in which Judge Shabazz sustained the jury's verdict on the grounds that the $290,000 was for units sold between 2003 and 2005, and that there was some inference that those had been lost because of some vague suggestions by two licensees that they hadn't reached the sales they thought they would in 2006. So nothing lines up. There is no way that you can go through the record and get from the licensee's testimony to the number 290,000 because the years don't match.
Did you give the jury a number, or did you just contend that there were zero damages?
We contended that there was zero damages. I see my time's up at this point.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Ahrens. Mr. Niederlich?
Thank you, Your Honor. Kurt Niederlucky, on behalf of Allen Block. I'd like to, as you mentioned earlier, add a little context as I begin here. County Materials, essentially, here has blatantly thumbed its nose at, number one, its contractual obligations, number two, Allen Block, and number three, the court itself. County and Allen Block agreed and contracted that in exchange for Allen Block's license to produce Allen Block's products under its marks and patents, and with Allen Block providing engineering, marketing, and sales support, all that is acknowledged in this court's September opinion, County Materials would not compete with Allen Block, either during the term of the contract or for 18 months afterwards. Their relationship lasted 12 years. So County came to this court in November of 2005, purportedly seeking a declaratory ruling from this court, or from the district court, excuse me, whether the 1993 covenant not to compete was valid and enforceable. Yet when it received what it wanted, a declaration as to the validity and enforceability of the non-compete, it ignored it. It ignored Allen Block's demand that it stop competing in light of that decision. It just simply kept competing.
Well, do you agree with Mr. Ahrens that the patent misuse issue is now out of the case?
I believe it is. It certainly directly applies to the 1993 agreement, Your Honor, and there was no evidence in this case either of market harm or harm to the proper economic market or market power on behalf of Analog. So given the facts in this case, the same would apply to the 1997 agreement under what was tried to the court. County Materials essentially argued to the jury that this was, in fact, not essentially, it did argue to the jury that it's okay. An economic, an efficient breach is part of a good society, and therefore, County Materials could breach the contract and just pay whatever damages Alan Block could prove at trial. The jury listened, and they found that Alan Block proved $290,000 worth of damages. The court listened and determined
that...
Well,
but Mr. Ahrens says there's no actual quantity, no quantity figures were presented to the jury that would enable them to quantify your damages.
I would disagree with Mr. Ahrens, and I find it interesting that while he says it's not, he's not able, or the jury wasn't able to quantify it, he certainly has been able to represent to the court today that he knows specifically what years the jury awarded damages for. He said, well, the jury awarded damages for 2003 to 2005, not after the termination of the agreement. Well, if there were no numbers, how did the jury know that? In fact, Alan Block presented a substantial amount of evidence through not its own witnesses in terms of the number of sales, because, of course, as this court is certainly aware, protective order was in place. Alan Block could not see what the amount of competing sales were. So when their president or their vice president was questioned on that, of course, he said, I can't tell you what that number is. But who could tell you that number was Dale Loren, who is County Materials sales manager, who was questioned on the stand, who got taken through every one of the sales reports to explain that for every competing product, when it was sold, to whom it was sold, went through all the Alan Block sales that County Material had, explained to whom it was sold, when it was sold.
And that testimony was limited or targeted at the 18-month period following termination?
No. In fact, the testimony specifically went from the 2003 to the 2005 in addition to the 18-month period.
How is it relevant to the damages for that 18-month period, which is, I assume, what we're focusing on, right?
We're actually not, Your Honor. The as it turned out, County Materials was not just breaching the contract during the 18-month non-compete after the termination, but it had been breaching the non-compete, we're not sure when it began, but certainly at least as early as 2003 by selling competing product.
Well, had you notified them and given them an opportunity to cure those earlier defaults?
At the time that we found out about them was after this litigation began, Your Honor. And so, no, we did not provide a written notice and under Section 9, because under Section 9, that deals with termination of the contract. It has nothing to do with, it is in no way preemptive or conditional upon our bringing a legal action. We brought a termination notice under Section 5, which is undisputed.
Well, what about, though, so Mr. Ahrens argues that during the 18-month period of the non-compete contract, if you claimed that they were violating that, you had to give them a notice of default.
I believe that's wrong, Your Honor. There's nothing in the contract that would require a notice of default post-termination of the contract, much less
Well, there's an ambiguity about termination, right? So the underlying contract is terminated, but then a new contract, the covenant not to compete, clicks in. So couldn't that be viewed as part of the original contract?
I don't believe that the 18-month non-compete is a new contract. It is part of the ongoing obligation of County Materials.
It's a contractual obligation of County Material.
That flows
contractual obligation is an obligation pursuant to contract. So there's certainly a sense in which the original contract wasn't completely terminated. That's his argument, that his county materials obligations continued for another 18 months.
I agree that the obligations continued. I would not agree that there was any obligation to cure, nor that there was another contract. It's very similar to confidentiality provisions, where certainly if you have an agreement to keep something confidential and that confidentiality obligation runs well beyond the termination of, for instance, an employment contract, that does not mean that someone would have to provide notice if trade secrets are misappropriated, for example.
Now, what are you seeking in your cross-appeal besides attorney's fees?
Your Honor, besides attorney's fees, we're seeking an extension of the injunction for the full 18-month period. We are seeking our attorney's fees, and we are seeking a rehearing on...
Well, didn't you get an extra 7 months?
We got 6.5 months, Your Honor, and...
Is it your view that 6.5 months is unrelated to your 18-month contractual entitlement?
The 6.5 months, obviously, just by math, is a little more than a third of the 18 months that the parties had agreed county materials would abide by.
But you weren't. But what you just said, I thought you weren't asking for another 11.5 months. You were asking for another 18 months.
No, Your Honor, if I said that, I was wrong.
We want a total of 18 months.
We want a total of 18 months, Your Honor, and certainly under Cherney, the Minnesota courts have indicated that the court has the power to extend that.
Well, what do you mean by extend that? I don't understand.
To extend it beyond the term, one of the arguments that defendant has made is that it is not appropriate to extend an injunction beyond the original term of the non-compete. Yet there's not one case that holds so.
Can you clear up something for me? Originally, this contract, as I understand it, permitted county materials to sell a couple of different kinds of blocks in addition to Allen block. Is that right?
Yes, they were allowed to sell two blocks that at the initiation of the contract they were selling.
All right, but those are those competing blocks?
Those would be competing blocks, Your Honor.
So they were an exception, though. They were allowed to do that, according to your interpretation.
Yes, under the 1993 agreement.
Besides this victory block thing, what is that the only one?
No, I mean,
they got a whole bunch of different ones.
They in 2006, knowing that the agreement had been held valid and enforceable, in addition to having previously sold blocks from 2003 to 2005, in fact came out with, I believe, 8 new blocks in competition during its non-compete period.
How can these things be so different that it's a concrete block?
There's a lot of intellectual property that goes into the concrete block industry. And
How different are these, one from the other?
A lot of them, they can be different both in appearance and in the manner in which they connect and make an integrated wall, Your Honor. So there's differences. There's obviously, as the court sees from this case, there are patentable differences because this license includes the ability to manufacture products under Allen Block's patent rights.
The 1997 agreement removed those two exceptions, as I understand it. What was the effect of the 97 agreement on the 93 agreement?
Your Honor, we have never contended. While the 97 agreement did not have those exceptions, that was an agreement that was assigned to and assumed by county materials, and Allen Block has never tried to argue that once they assigned that agreement to county materials that they couldn't use the exception from their prior agreement. So Allen Block has allowed them to continue manufacturing the county block.
And so you have not sought to enforce the broader non-compete clause in the 97 agreement then? Is that what you're saying?
Correct. We did not do that in this case, Your Honor.
Because the 97 agreement otherwise subsumed the earlier agreement. Is that right?
No, they were two separate agreements that gave two separate areas of Wisconsin exclusive manufacturing rights.
Well, as I looked at it, though, the 93 agreement covered northern Wisconsin and the 97 agreement covered the entire state.
I believe the 97 agreement covered the southeast portion of Wisconsin. The 93 agreement covered the northwest portion. And then 97 might have also covered part of the very northernmost part of Illinois. But it's an exclusive manufacturing agreement.
Right, I understand that. But the territory in the 97 agreement is the entire state of Wisconsin. And that's why I was a little confused about which agreement actually controls the litigation. But you're telling me you haven't sought to enforce the second one?
Not in a more broad circumstance on the county block that was accepted out of the first one. I think the reason it looks that way, I think the copy the court must have, I believe there was some highlighting on the area of Wisconsin that was included there. And how these work is it's an exclusive manufacturing agreement, but a non-exclusive sales agreement. So they have an exclusive territory in which they manufacture, and, of course, blocks are very heavy, so practically speaking, you can't sell them very far without incurring a lot of transportation costs. But the but then they could sell them wherever they would like. Getting back to the length of the injunction, Your Honor, the cases...
But, look, so you've got damages for... the breach of the covenant not to be, right?
Yeah, and as far as we can tell,
damages. If you get an award of damages, the only basis for an injunction is that the damages somehow are not adequate, can't measure the loss, something of that sort. So unless you have that kind of argument, I don't see what entitlement you have to an additional injunction.
First of all, Your Honor, I think the court recognized that in non-compete cases, damages are extremely difficult to prove.
But you sued for damages, and you got damages.
And interestingly enough, we did not get damages for breach of the 18-month non-compete. As Mr.
You asked for them, didn't you?
Yes.
Well, but the jury decided you didn't have any damages, then what's the basis for an injunction?
Well, in addition, I believe to the fact that damages are very difficult to prove and make whole, the continuing damage to Allen Block's future business, the failure of allowing Allen Block to compete in a market that County Materials, who had sold Allen Block for 12 years, is not in, allows Allen Block to reestablish itself in the marketplace, and the parties agreed.
You negotiated with them for 18 months. You could have negotiated for 24 or 30 months. So why aren't you stuck with you thought when you signed the contract that 18 months was enough to enable you to readjust to the termination of the contract. So I don't see how the court can come along and say, well, yeah, made a mistake. 18 months was too short. I'm going to give you another 6 months.
Your Honor, I don't think anyone has alleged that 18 months was too short. The County Materials has...
18 months wasn't too short. 18 months has expired, and you got... you tried to get damages, and the jury said no, there was no harm from any breach of the 18-month period. And I don't see what you've lost. I don't get it, what you've lost. You lost.
Your Honor, I think...
If you did something bad to you in the 18 months, then the jury would have given you damages.
I would disagree with that, Your Honor. I think the courts, and I apologize, I can't give you a specific cite, but certainly within our briefs, the courts recognize that you can obtain damages for the past harm for the breach of the non-compete, and in addition, obtain an injunction for the continuing harm
failure. Not if you seek damages for breaches during the covenant period, and the jury decides there are no damages, there were no harm. You weren't harmed during that 18-month period, then it's as if you'd had your 18 months, right?
I would disagree, Your Honor. I don't think it is there.
Suppose during the 18-month period, Allen Block County said, well, we don't think this covenant is enforceable. We're not going to pay any attention to it. But it turns out that they don't do anything during the period that actually harms you. Why would you be entitled to relief? No harm, no...
We did present evidence of harm, and the harm is...
The jury didn't agree with you, right?
But the harm is not just monetary.
Well, I don't understand that. You're just a company, right? What's non-monetary? Emotional distress or what?
The goodwill of this company?
That's monetary. You can ask a jury to award damages for impairment of goodwill.
But that's a time period beyond... the period at which trial occurred. Now, certainly, because they had not complied for one day with their non-compete, not even for one day up to trial, Alan Block would have had to try to demonstrate what it could have done in that market had it had 18 full months of non-compete. What happened is Alan Block and
When was the trial? So the contract was terminated when?
August 25th, 2005, Your Honor, was the effective date of the
termination. When was the trial?
Trial was in December 27th of 2006, approximately 16 months later.
Okay, so you have 16 months of the covenant not to compete, and you asked the jury to award damages for that. So they didn't think that was. Are you saying there was harm? There would be harm in the last 2 months, or?
Not only harm in the last 2 months, but there's a continuing future harm. The future sales.
Well, did you ask the jury for damages for this continuing future harm?
We did not ask beyond the sales that we could demonstrate under.
You say that hurt your goodwill. Why didn't you have an expert witness say, yeah, the value of this company has been reduced by this behavior by county?
It would be very difficult to demonstrate, and it would be based on future activity that is very difficult to determine. The fact is, at that time...
So why didn't you make clear to the jury that you were just asking for damages for 2003 to 2005? Why did you ask for damages for the breach of the covenant?
We asked for a very limited amount of damages. We asked for a period of 2003 to 2005 in the amount of $290,000. We asked for damages solely related to customers that Alan Block had, that County Materials sold to after 2005. As we said...
In violation of the covenant.
In violation of the covenant, but only the customers that they had sold to that were already Alan Block customers. All the other customers...
You can't bring two cases for damages incurred in the same period, and one of them is for damages for... some customers, and the other is damages for goodwill. You can't. I mean, that is splitting a claim.
Hey, Your Honor, I think Cherney, the Minnesota Supreme Court case on this issue, said you can obtain both money damages and injunctive relief for that
breach.
My
first example is two suits for damages, one for some customers, one for some. You can't do that, right? If you ask for damages for both and jury says no damages, no harm, then I don't see how you can get an injunction.
I don't think the jury says no damages, no harm.
They awarded zero damages. That's equivalent to saying there's no monetizable harm.
Correct, and it's the irreparable harm that the injunction would apply for. It's the harm of County Materials failing to comply with its 18 months of non-compete.
What would that harm be? Okay, so they're thumbing their nose at the covenant not to compete. What harm does... What do you mean that it harms your goodwill? What does that mean?
They continue. We bring in licensees to invest in a market. We have been marketing our products for County Materials. County Materials has used our trademark to establish goodwill with all the customers in Wisconsin. And the point of the non-compete was 18 months to allow Alan Block to come back in and reestablish new licensees to deal with that goodwill and build up that goodwill. We lost that opportunity, Your Honor.
So you're saying during the period they stole licensees from you, or they signed up companies, distributors that would have, or builders or what have you, that would have gone with you instead?
Your Honor, my time's up, but I'll answer your question quickly. My argument isn't that they stole them, it's that they retained them, and they had an obligation to release them, essentially, everybody practically knows it's a lot harder to get new business than it is to keep current business.
Wouldn't that result in a loss of sales for you?
Into the future, as the licensees reestablish themselves, and there's testimony at least as to some of the initial attempts of the licensees.
They retained distributors that they should have released for you. Why wouldn't that cause you a loss during the 16 months?
We try to demonstrate the loss during the period that we could with those customers that we could specifically identify were previous Allen Block customers. All of the other customers we could not establish were had been sold Allen Block product, but Allen Block could have competed for were not in our damages.
Let me ask you just one more question. So with regard to your request for attorney's fees, so you can only get attorney's fees by demonstrating a default, right? Isn't that what the contract says?
No, Your Honor. We can get attorney's fees for any default within the agreement.
Right, a default. You have to show a default. Right.
And the parties have agreed that default means breach. Both parties.
And so is this the breach of the covenant or the breach of the original contract or both that you're asking attorney's fees for?
The breach of the covenant not to compete that was in place during the contract and was supposed to be in place for a period of 18 months post.
Fees for your cost of trying to enforce the covenant, is that correct?
Correct, Your Honor, and that's where we have stated in our briefs that by the court's decision, it has removed essentially the term any default by producer and has changed it to say specifically only a default for failure to pay money would allow you to collect your attorney's fees, and we believe that removed the any, and in fact the court was supplied with supplemental authority by County Materials, Matrix Group v. Rawlings Sporting Goods, which is an Eighth Circuit case. And in that case, that court actually looked specifically at the term any and had said you can't remove the term any. That was dealing with a material or non-material breach. And the Eighth Circuit said it is all breaches, not just one of them, and by taking it out, you remove any.
I have a question about the damages calculation before you sit down. The number that the jury arrived at, this $290,000 in damages, was derived from a mathematical computation that consisted of the 785,000 competing units of block, as I understand it, times the royalty. Is that right?
Yes, times an average royalty historically over the company.
And that number, the 785 units of competing block, did that include the two lines, the Keystone and County Cub, that were essentially barred by the district court's treatment of the 13A issue?
No, Your Honor, it did not. We specifically removed them in the damages phase of the case based on the court's decision and the jury's verdict on those two.
So on your declaratory judgment exception to Rule 13A argument, you're asking for an opportunity to present that to the jury?
Yes, we're asking for a rehearing specifically on those two products as to damages. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Niederlund. Mr. Ahrens, how much time does he have?
I believe I've reserved 7 minutes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Well, first of all, I'd like to call the court's attention back to the jury instruction. And the jury instruction was, quote, in answering the question of the special verdict, you are to determine the amount of money that will fairly and adequately compensate plaintiff Allen Block Corporation for damages caused by defendant County Materials Corporation or Corporation's breach of the covenants not to compete. So the instruction, not objected to by Allen, was a full damage remedy. There was no accepting out anything. It was to make them whole. Under Lesmeister versus Dilley, damages for contract are benefit of the bargain. And that is the benefit that instruction tells the jury it should give to Allen Block. Allen Block got that benefit. One of the things that I want to address about the non-compete clause is that the trial court found a presumption of irreparable harm based on Overholt, which is an Eighth Circuit case. However, as we have presented, Overholt doesn't have a non-compete clause in it. Overholt there was not an issue of attempting to prevent all competition, but an injunction issued to prevent the use of confidential information and the contacting of individual customers. Contrary to what Mr. Niederlicke has suggested, there was no separating out of Allen Block, quote, customers from others. There was no analysis of customers. There was no analysis of customer preferences, of what they bought. There was no differentiation between the kinds of things that parties find useful in different products. There was no way in any form or fashion to recreate the relevant market and suggest what Allen's appropriate market share would have been. Now, that's a bedrock principle of this court's jurisprudence about proving damages when we're dealing with a counterfactual situation, which is what we're dealing with here. What would have happened had? And that's exactly when this court has said repeatedly, I mean, as recently as this summer with two of the members of this panel in Kixon, saying that you have to have competent experts, you have to have testable hypotheses. In Zenith, which is perhaps the leading case in this court, say-so is not enough. And all we have here is say-so. We have say-so from a couple licensees that they thought they didn't sell as much. They never told you how many units they fell short by. They didn't even give you any projections. Then we have say-so that we would have made those sales. And yet all we do, all the plaintiff has done, is present the total number of our sales and multiply it by a royalty. Well, they needed to take the total number of our sales that they contended were inappropriate, and then they needed to say, because our market share was 15% or 5% or 30%, we would have made 5, 10, or whatever that percentage was. They never made any attempt to do that. Now, Mr. Niedelecki talks about how it's difficult to calculate damages, but there was no testimony that there was any impediment here to the calculations of damages. And this court's jurisprudence is replete with cases where we have a counterfactual situation. That's Zenith, that's Kixon, a counterfactual situation where the plaintiff still has to go through the process of putting together a damages case. One of the cases that I noticed to the court on Friday, and I apologize for doing my homework, is the Hines case, which is decided by Judge Schultz out of the Minnesota District Court. And he says the plaintiff has to separate out those factors in the marketplace and segregate those out from the damages allegedly caused by the breach. No effort to do that here. So finally, on the issue of attorney's fees, the language in the particular says is, in case of any default by producer, as specified herein. So at trial, the plaintiff kept arguing, well, we don't need to give you notice because we're claiming breach, not default. And we said, well, it's the same thing. But there is a specific way that default is defined in this agreement. Events of default. And there's a list of things that constitutes events of default in Section 9. Section 9.2. If you declare an event of default, that is, after you've given the notice and cure, and it's not been cured, you can terminate or seek all remedies available at law and equity. Now, there's only one way of reading that. That is that the notice of default is a prerequisite to doing that which is in 9.2. Now, of course, it's not a prerequisite to terminating the clause under Section 5 for no fault, but it is for declaring a default. We go to Section 10.2, in case of any default, as specified herein. There is, as specified, means a default linked back to the notice provisions. No notice was given. Now, the simple matter here is that Allen wants to get from this court what no Minnesota judge would give it. Very clearly, Overholt wouldn't give irreparable harm for non-compete, but only for use of confidential information.
Sure, you're Judge. Right. So the purpose of giving notice of a default to enable the other side to cure. Now, according to Alan Block, they didn't discover these breaches until they brought the suit.
Well, Mr. Niedelecki, I think it slipped his mind because there was testimony at trial that Allen's president, Mr. Gravier, knew of the sales of both Keystone and County Cup as early as 2003. That's what was
Isn't that something for the judge to rule on? I mean, it'd be bound by a jury finding, but shouldn't he make the determination in the attorney's fees proceeding whether there was whether Alan Block was aware
I don't see how the awareness has anything to do with attorney's fees, because it has to do with this.
Understand that if they didn't know, if Alan Block didn't know there had been a breach until the trial, then it wouldn't be barred because it hadn't issued a notice of default, surely.
I think, may I ask another question? The notice of default enforces a duty of candor between the parties about their relationship. And a party who has this...
In words, if they don't know that you have broken the contract, then I don't see how they can be faulted for not having sent a notice of default.
But they knew.
Well, did the judge find that?
Well, the jury found that.
Well, did the jury actually find that, or is that your inference from the evidence?
The jury found that they knew before the answer in the second case, or in the first case. The jury found that because that was a specific question as to the date. There was testimony that they knew.
Testimony. I'm just interested in what the jury found.
The jury found that Alan Block knew that County was selling the County Cub and the Keystone prior to the time that they filed their answer.
You're saying the jury found that Block was aware of all these breaches. Is that what you're saying?
Well, under Minnesota...
Is that what you're saying?
Yes, that's what I'm saying.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you to both counsel.